University of Illinois Employees Credit Union, a full-service financial institution serving campus and community. The University of Illinois Employees Credit Union. More information available online at uiecu.org.
It's 12:37. A southwest wind will usher in warmer air into the Midwest for the next couple of days. Meanwhile, a low-pressure system is developing over the plains today. Upper-level disturbances streaming northeast ahead of the main storm system will begin to increase the chances of rain from west to east overnight. A period of rain and thunderstorms will affect the region Friday night and into Saturday, and locally heavy rainfall will be possible. High temperatures today will range from the mid-30s in southern Wisconsin to around 60 degrees in southern Missouri, and lows overnight will range from the low 30s in northern Iowa to the upper 40s in southern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a high of 48. The wind out of the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers after midnight. We should see an overnight low of 42. The wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy. Rain is likely. It will be warmer. The high, 58. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night, showers and thunderstorms and a low of 42. Saturday, rain is likely in the morning. There's a chance of rain or snow showers in the afternoon. The temperature should hold steady in the low 40s. Saturday night, cloudy with a chance of snow early. Colder with a low in the mid-20s. Sunday and Sunday night, partly cloudy with a high around 40 and a low in the mid-20s. And the outlook for Monday, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-40s. At noon Central Time, temperatures in Illinois were in the 40s. I don't have any conditions and temperatures to report from Indiana today. 41 degrees at noon at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. At Kankakee, it was 41. Bloomington Normal, 42. Springfield, 46. And Mattoon, 48. At the top of the hour at Willard Airport, 45 degrees. The wind out of the east at 15 miles per hour. The relative humidity, 56%. And I don't have a dew point or a barometric reading for you today. I'm sorry about that. And at 12:40 Central Time, 45 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky is cloudy. Apple CEO Steve Jobs surprised an audience in San Francisco yesterday when he appeared on stage to introduce the new version of the iPad. Jobs has been on a medical leave since January. More from NPR's Laura Seidel.
No one was expecting Jobs at the event. But there he was on stage looking much as he had for several years, painfully thin but energetic, wearing his trademark mock turtleneck and blue jeans.
I'm blown away with this stuff.
As always, he was a cheerleader for Apple, touting the more than 15 million in iPad sales. The iPad has created a new market for tablet computers. Now, he noted, all the tech companies are following along.
Everybody's got a tablet. Is 2011 going to be the year of the copycats?
They may copy, says Jobs, but they aren't going to catch up. And with his usual confidence, he introduced the iPad 2, which includes a camera and a dual-core processor. It's a couple of ounces lighter than the first version and costs the same. Apple shareholders keep a close eye on Jobs' health. Although Jobs founded the company, he was pushed out in the 1980s. When he returned in 1997, Apple was on the verge of bankruptcy. But with Jobs at the helm, Apple has released one blockbuster after another. Since 2004, he's been fighting a rare but treatable form of pancreatic cancer. He took a medical leave in 2009 and announced it would be for 6 months. This time, he hasn't said when he will return full-time. COO Tim Cook has been running day-to-day operations. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And today we wrap up a three-part series from Transportation Nation about mass transit, race, and inequality. As American cities invest in light rail, they are finding that property values near train stops are booming, and people with low incomes can no longer afford to live there. Andrea Bernstein takes a look at Denver, a city undergoing the largest expansion of mass transit in the country.
I first went to cover Denver's transit system in the fall of 2009. The country was a year into the recession, but next to Union Station, backhoes were actively preparing land for new condos. Tom Clark heads the Chamber of Commerce here. He was telling me the city had been caught off guard by the demand for these buildings, even in these times.
As I drive home every night and look at the young people coming out of these condos, I wonder, they must have really rich parents. That's the only way I can figure out they can afford to live there.
What's driving all this is the promise of transit. Right now, light rail brings about 6,000 people a day here. In a decade, it's expected to bring 20 times that amount.
Come out here.
The tour ended in a small grassy park where officials arrayed themselves around a podium. U.S. Housing Secretary Sean Donovan praised Denver's big transit expansion, called Fast Tracks. But at the same time, he warned, poor families will be pushed out. So Donovan cut a check for a brand new apartment building.
$10 million for Denver's South Lincoln Park development.
A year and a half later, I went back to Denver to see what happened to all that money. In fact, the building was going up.
Right here is where a new 100 units is being built, 100 units of public housing.
Ismael Guerrero, the public housing authority chief, took me over for a look. On the chain link construction fence, there was a picture of what the new building was going to look like. Nice.
You're going to have phenomenal views of the entire Front Range.
The son of Mexican immigrants, Guerrero grew up in public housing in Chicago. He calls it a twist of fate that in Denver, public housing was built down by the tracks on land that was completely undesirable. Now, he says, they'll be able to build 7,000 units for mostly Mexican-American and African-American residents right on the rail line.
It's our land. We control it. We're planning the future of it.
Back in the 1920s and 1930s, streetcars crisscrossed America's cities. Denver was no exception, with 300 miles. By the 1960s, there were no trains at all. Meanwhile, the population was rising from 5% Latino and African American to 35%, and that population was vocally demanding better schools.
Our kids are just as smart as anybody else's kids, given the opportunities.
Denver became the first non-Southern city where the U.S. Supreme Court ordered racial integration in schools. I learned this history from Federico Peña, who would be the mayor and later served two cabinet posts in the Clinton administration. As the city was emptying out, he began to restore the downtown. In an era where most people were only thinking about cars, he supported urban transit.
So let's do an experiment. Let's have one small rail link, and let's put it right in the middle of the African-American community from downtown. And it was free.
That neighborhood was Five Points. In the 1920s and 1930s, it was called the Harlem of the West. Louis Armstrong played here. So did Billie Holiday. But in the 1960s and 70s, some of the elaborate Victorian homes were razed, leaving a patchwork of empty lots. Then the light rail came, and development is following.
Look, it is open.
Aaron Mirapol heads up a group called the Urban Land Conservancy. It's modeled after the Nature Conservancy, but the Urban Conservancy is not trying to keep land pristine. Instead, they're buying up parcels along the rail line. They'll preserve it for homes people can afford.
This is a co-op on your right that we bid on and we lost, unfortunately. So market rate developer bought this co-op in the last 6 months. And we'll hold it, and when the market changes, we'll be able to make a lot of money on it.
Mirapol's group is one of a handful of nonprofits trying to outmaneuver market-rate developers in Denver. And you can see why Five Points is interesting to them. The homes have the kind of historical details that drive buyers gaga. Stained glass, carved wooden mantels, elegant molding. But the land rush is happening in neighborhoods that don't have the same cachet. Melinda Pollack and Karen Lotto take me over to Denver's West Side. They work for Enterprise Community Partners, a group that has carefully documented how transit will increase demand for affordable housing by 344%.
I was going to say, you know, right now we're looking at a kind of a dilapidated strip mall with a pawn shop and a liquor store and a couple of restaurants and some empty storefronts.
The Jody apartments are nearby. They look like an unrenovated 1950s motel, white metal stairs leading past brick up to a dark green second story. The whole thing horseshoeing around a parking lot.
This is the staging area you're going right on. So their parcel, the Jody Apartments, abuts where the light rail station is going to be built.
Lotto and Pollock tell me about how their group's purchase of this land came about. It wasn't long after the 2004 vote to give the green light for a new sales tax for 150 miles of new transit with 50 new stations.
And then there was a huge flurry of discussion, you know, really looking at this transit build-out as making the opportunity to make Metro Denver a world-class city.
It's a short drive back from this site to Federico Pena's office in downtown Denver. I asked Pena whether American cities will look back 50 years from now and compare light rail expansions like Denver's to the highway boom of the 1950s, except in reverse. Will American city centers in 2050 be mostly upper income with everyone else living on the outskirts?
Well, it's a good question. The day that you sit back and say, I don't care, just let the economic market forces dictate who's going to live where and what's going to happen to your city, then I do think we run the risk of having almost a push out of low-income minority communities away from our inner cities and pushed out 20 or 30 or 40 miles.
That's a 21st century form of segregation this city is trying to avoid. In Denver, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
You can learn more about Transportation Nation at transportationnation.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2011 lecture series presents Independent and Community Archives, Preserving Local Histories and Sites of Resistance by Andrew Flynn on Wednesday, March 9th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
And here's the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 3rd of March, 2011. 1802, on this day, Beethoven published the Moonlight Sonata, the Sonata number 14 in C-sharp minor, opus 27, number 2, which was very popular in his own time, which did not please Beethoven. He said, "Surely I've written better things." 1875, on this day, the opera Carmen appeared on stage for the first time at the Opéra Comique in France. The audience shocked by the characters of Carmen, a gypsy girl, her lover, Don José. Georges Bizet died of a heart attack just 3 months after the debut. It was on this day, 1923, Time magazine was first published. Still the most widely read weekly news magazine in the world, though